Okay, ladies and gentlemen, when I finished doing the review of our wrap-up with Dr. Farrell several weeks ago, it never occurred to me I'd have him back right away. But we had the Secret Space Program Conference in Bastrop, Texas, not this last weekend, but the weekend before. And frankly, it was so juicy, so amazing, so exciting, so deeply satisfying that I finally said to explain it to everybody before I encourage you all to go out and get 15 hours of stream. I said, I got to get Joseph back, and we have to give people an overview, a recap, and talk about some of the most amazing insights that came out of it. So, Joseph, with no further ado, thank you so much for coming right back on and doing this. We really appreciate it.
Sure.
Anyway, so I want to first just walk through and introduce the different presentations quickly. So just spend about a minute or two on each one. So before people dive into the stream, they know what's there. So I'll never forget, I had amazing, of course, there was terrible weather. We were all flying in. People had a lot of flight troubles. And I was boarding my plane in Chicago. And there were two people in front of me talking about the conference. And they turned to me and said, oh my God, it's Catherine Austin Fitz. And we started to talk. Anyway, so I talked to them when I got off the plane. And one of them said, God, I'm so exhausted. They've been flying all day trying to get through the weather. And the other said, let's sleep late. And the other said, well, who's speaking first? And someone said, oh, Farrell's first. And she said, there's no way we're missing that. We just won't get any sleep. So I thought that was a very high compliment. I had to laugh. So anyway, you were first. So just give us a minute or two on your first presentation, because you did two, one on Saturday, one on Sunday.
Yeah, it was kind of a two-part thing, separated by everybody else, but it kind of worked out.
Yeah, it did.
Because we none of us coordinated with each other. It was another one of those things where I was just kind of amazed that everybody meshed so well together. But the first talk I did was Saturday morning, and I called it Cosmic War, Cosmic Versailles, because I've been talking about this Versailles template that I've been using to look at what I think was an ancient cosmic war in our solar system and how it might have been looked at by the American national security establishment after World War II, because many of them had their political and geopolitical experience cut during World War I, during the Treaty of Versailles. So that's what I did. It was kind of a two-part discussion. And then the last one on Sunday was Cosmic Versailles, Cosmic War. In other words, we're going from treaty provisions that might be there in the record of ancient lore to possibilities that they might have violated those treaty provisions.
Well, it may, you know, modern history makes a lot more sense if you look at it from the prism of treaty provisions.
Yeah, it does. It does.
It does. And I think the hard part about this is, and why your work is so valuable, you have to connect a lot of different dots in a lot of different areas, both, you know, through time.
Right.
And so there's an awful lot of dot connecting, but it went very smoothly. It was very clear, and it made a lot of sense.
Yeah, I had a lot of people commenting on it after I was done, coming up to me and saying, wow, we never looked at it that way. And, you know, just to give you one example that I mentioned in the talk is if there is some sort of cosmic Versailles treaty that's been in play or was put into play at some point, then that's an interesting rationalization for why we put all those placards on our space probes. You know, we came in peace for all mankind, we're coming in peace. Well, you know, that's kind of a little way of having your white flag fleet, you know, that you're sailing around the world and we're here on a peaceful mission. So yeah, it's an interesting perspective.
So next up was your ally and friend Walter Bosley in a very, very interesting presentation that you normally don't see when, you know, the topic of what's going on in space comes up. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think it's a hugely important topic. In fact, I was kind of encouraging Yair and the conference organizer to invite Walter, because Walter's been doing a really interesting series of research connecting some dots with the 19th century airship mystery and going through the details. And in my opinion, Walter is the first one to solve a persisting mystery about the airships. And this is this so-called German organization that is known in the airship literature as NIMSA. Mm-hmm. And he has, I think, successfully proposed an acronym for this, National Flying Machine Payment Office. In other words, it's a secret society, basically, that like right. the Americans that were involved in creating these airship machines back in the 19th century, they're developing black technology. Right. And interestingly enough, it appears that they're developing black technology sort of as a private interest. You get kind of the impression that the connections to government are very loose and tenuous, be they right. to the American or to the Prussian government. So what Walter was proposing, I think, is a very interesting thesis. We talk about the idea of the breakaway civilization originating in the 20th century, but he's pushing the roots of this phenomena back into the 19th century, and I think there's an arguable case there. He presented some, you know, I don't want to give away his talk and all the details, but he presented some very, very interesting details arguing for right. that being the case and making some very, very strange connections on top of it. So right. all in all, it was really, in my opinion, one of the better presentations at the conference.
Well, you can't look at the breakaway issue with looking back into the, you know, way beyond the 20th century.
Right.
Because something's going, yeah. One of my favorite was Dr. Paul Lavalette, the next, who I think was invited at your recommendation.
Yeah, they asked me if what I would think about having Dr. Lavalette to the conference, and I said you must have him to the conference. He spoke on reverse engineering certain technologies, talked a great deal about actually existing advanced propulsion technologies, showed some videos of these things being tested, and tried to put it all within his own analysis of modern contemporary physics, which in his opinion, and I agree with him, is a deeply flawed model. He has been out there for literally two decades championing the idea that physics is the public physics is at a dead end, Catherine, because it's a closed system physics. It's not an open system physics. And the real data is that we're dealing with an open system physics. And he's been arguing this case for many, many years. What he did during his presentation was to kind of update and extend the remarks that he made in just a superb publication of his called Secrets of Anti-Gravity Propulsion. And he said one thing, I could have stood up and cheered, he said one thing that really stuck in my mind. Physics is a religion. And when he said that, I just, you know, I had to laugh, and I was outside smoking at the time, but I was listening to him on the speaker system, and I had to laugh and applaud because, you know, he really has pulled the mask off of, in his presentation, a lot of the presuppositions of mainstream physics, if you listen to him carefully. And I think by the end of the talk, you'll see that, you know, there's something else going on in the world of physics, and it's quite different from what we're being told about dark matter and relativity and, you know, quasars and so on and so forth. It's very, very
right.
different.
Okay, so then next up was that wonderful Texan Jim Morris.
Yeah, I unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to see Jim. You know what happened to me?
Oh, I did.
After Walter spoke, I went outside to smoke, and I was mobbed by people, so I had to listen.
Yeah,
to
you
him.
Were mobbed, yeah.
Yeah, I was mobbed. But Jim did an interesting presentation. I did listen to some of it online about the remote viewing of aliens, and the interesting thing I think here that we have to bear in mind is when we're talking about secret space programs and breakaway civilizations, and I think Jim kind of has been underscoring this in his books and in his presentations. The national security establishment is going to use any and every means necessary to figure out what they're dealing with the UFO phenomenon, and how to deal with it. And that includes, you know, things that we would call parapsychological or paranormal things like remote viewing. They're going to be going back to ancient lore and looking at some of that, as I've been arguing. They are going to use every resource that they can. Now, it's very interesting to me. I think that in his presentation, he's pointed out that there had actually been remote viewing efforts made prior to actual space probes going to places and finding the things they did, particularly in the case of Mars. If I recall correctly, he mentioned James Hertak remote viewing the face. But the point here is that he's making is whether or not you follow any one specific story, they're going to be doing this stuff to figure out what's going on.
Right.
And I'll tell you something, as I was listening or trying to listen, I was being talked at so much during his presentation. One of the things that struck me is, yes, they're going to remote view for artifacts out there. There's going to be a remote viewing space archaeology program going on.
Right.
And I think the things that he talked about, I think, quite frankly, Catherine, are just really the tip of the iceberg. I really do.
A couple years ago, I sat down and got all of Ingo Swann's books and read everything I could get my hands on and watched some of his speeches. He was one of the remote viewers. And,
right. You
know, it's a fascinating body of work by an amazing person. And I was really glad that Jim gave sort of an overview of Swann and his work. And I think that was, for people who haven't been introduced to it, was invaluable.
Anyway, well, there's something else. Let me add one little tidbit, you know, about this. There is something going on behind the scenes, and I'll tell you why. We have the story, of course, of Dr. James Hertak remote viewing the face on Mars before the Viking probe ever went and took its picture. But there's also something very weird, and you know, I wish Jay Dyer were on the conversation with us. He might know more about this than I do, and because he put this up on his show, on his presentation. There was actually a comic book back in the late 1950s featuring a face on Mars. So you have to wonder just exactly what's going on. Is this coming through synchronicity? Is this being remote viewed at that early day and they're letting out the information early? You know, what's going on? I don't know, but it's very, very interesting.
Right.
Anyway, I didn't mean to get off on that tangent.
No, I think that. And in fact, it was Jay Dyer who was up next. And so
Yep. Why
don't we dive in and explain his presentation, which I thought was fantastic.
It was fantastic, and it was another one of those presentations that took you by surprise.
Uh-huh.
Because Jay did an analysis of the James Bond films Moonraker, and connecting some dots that I had never heard of before to
Hollywood always tells you. You know, they always tell
Hollywood,
you what's really going on.
They do.
Right.
The film Moonraker with Roger Moore and Michael Lonsdale. And then Diamonds Are Forever, of course, which is one of the late and last Sean Connery Bond movies, which has always been, to me, just patently obvious. A German scientist working for an American black project building space lasers. You know, I mean, come on here. And in addition to this, we have a recluse billionaire hanging out in a Las Vegas penthouse, played by Jimmy Dean. So he really tied this together. And then the other thing he was doing was, it was not only pointing out how Hollywood did this, he was using academic studies to do this. And he also referenced yet another one of my favorite science fiction authors, not necessarily in film, but an author, and that's Isaac Asimov in the Foundation trilogy.
Yeah.
It was really an astounding presentation, and he gave me some information, some good sources. He was referencing at one time an academic study, actually, of the James Bond, Ian Fleming films called Narrative Structure in Ian Fleming. So it was really a deeply grounded presentation. This wasn't just somebody getting up there and saying, oh, I think Hollywood is sending messages, you know, because I feel that way. No, he was connecting detailed dots to actual movies, actual books, and things that were actually going on in the covert world and in the scientific world at the time. Just really a truly good presentation.
Right. And then there was a panel that night. I don't know if you've seen it. I saw it. And just a lot of conversation between that group. And Walter brought out more about the, you know, his topic, which I thought, you know, his chance to bring out a little bit more was interesting. And then the next day was Sunday, and we started off with Dr. John Brandenburg. Did you see that?
Yes, I did. In fact, I know John. We spoke at another conference years and years ago together, and we sat back in the back talking a little bit before he got up to do his presentation. Dr. Brandenburg is a plasma physicist that had worked at Sandia Laboratories at one point in his career. I believe now he's working for Los Alamos, but he's also become something of a kind of, I don't know what you call him, planetary scientist, because he is fascinated by Mars. He's been involved with the Mars anomaly research almost from the very earliest days with people like Richard Hoagland, Mark Carlotto, Pozos, and all of those that were involved in looking at the Martian anomalies very, very early on. And Dr. Brandenburg gave, I think, probably, again, one of the more stunning presentations, because what he argued was the presence of xenon-129 isotope on Mars in the highly concentrated and massively unusual percentages argues quite strongly that there was some sort of nuclear explosion, or explosions, I should say, that occurred on the surface of Mars. And you can't have, and this is the key point, you can't have those types of nuclear explosions producing xenon-129 by accident. In other words, what he's saying is these were weapons that were used on the surface of Mars for some purpose. You know, and to me, this is just another, you know, confirmation of the cosmic war hypothesis. Not necessarily in all the details that I get into, but you don't need to agree with each other on the details.
Right.
What we're trying to do, you know, is show that the history of our very own local solar system is deeply scarred, that something happened here. It was quite catastrophic. And Brandenburg just knocked it right out of the park with what he was showing, with the graphs, the charts, and most importantly, the pictures. Just stunning stuff.
So, yeah, it was pretty stunning. And, you know, you got the feeling you got in many of these presentations, because what you're realizing is each one of these people is a very serious person.
Yeah.
Who at one point early in their career decides to stick with facts and reality as opposed to go with the official reality.
Yep.
And exactly. You can see in each one of their lives they branch off and they just keep going with reality, which keeps moving them in a vector away from, you know, their colleagues and the official reality.
Yep.
And one of the sort of sub-themes I kept thinking about is, what is it defines all these fabulous people? Because you're talking about people with extraordinary personal integrity, you know, one after another, who have just stuck with the facts and the truth.
Well,
you know, it's almost like you were in the presence of real scientists.
Well, that's, yes, exactly. That's the first thing that I noticed is that, you know, listening to everybody, you know, we have to get out of our heads that science is only done by people that actually go and you know, achieve academic degrees in some particular science. This really is a very, very late development within the Western academic tradition. Science itself has a long tradition of being done basically by, you know, to use my expression, hacks and amateurs.
Right.
But the other very interesting thing that I think stands out, particularly when you look at people like Bosley with his intelligence background, or Brandenburg or Laviolette, particularly, is these are people that are also generalists. In other words, they're not, you know, Brandenburg's specialty is plasma physics, and here he's talking about planetary physics and geological anomalies that
right.
cannot be explained geologically, that they're artificial. Well, if you look at people like this, they're generalists. In other words, they're not so stuck in one discipline. And in fact, Dr. LaViolette even pointed this out at one point during his talk, that there are certain people that are able to think analogically. And when he said that, I could have stood up and cheered because, you know, I've been big on this idea of
yes.
analogical thinking for some time. I think what happens, you look at each of those people, Catherine, I know it's true of you, it's true of me, it's true of Brandenburg and the other speakers there, is that something happens at some point early in their career that they begin, they bump into an anomaly so huge
right.
that the official narratives really can't explain it away. And once you look at those narratives and then confront the anomaly, you either have one of two choices. You've got to maintain your integrity and investigate it, or go with the official narrative.
Right.
And what's really interesting is you see all of those speakers challenging some aspect, some huge aspect of the official narrative. In some major way. And that's really, you know, you put it all together, all those presentations at this conference, and the bottom line is each major sticking point of the official narrative, there's nothing out there, don't worry about it, you know, it's a trick of light and shadow, you know, there's nothing
right.
going on, there's nothing going on in the movies, and, you know, so on and so forth.
Well, the combination, the intellectual power of that, as well as their personal integrity and courage,
yeah,
was what was so compelling. It was that's
exactly.
why I said it was deeply gratifying.
Yeah, it was. It was a grounded,
yeah.
you know, the other thing about the conference, since we're talking about this, it's grounded. We had, and you were there for the roundtable discussions, we had people asking us, well, why don't you invite the storytellers and the whistleblowers?
Right.
And, you know, the consensus was we don't invite them to these conferences because there's enough conferences where they do get invited and that's all you hear.
Right.
The researchers at those conferences are outnumbered, outflanked, and their message gets lost in the noise.
Well, but if you look at the audience, it was the serious people. You know, it's amazing if you look in that audience. These are people who know how to run companies. These are people who know how to build bridges. These are people who know how to get things done in the real world. They're serious. You had a lot of scientists, you had a lot of engineers, you had a lot of entrepreneurs. These are people who are quietly powerful.
Right.
And they don't want any of that stuff.
They don't want any of that stuff, and neither did the presenters.
Right.
You know, and this to me is the biggest thing about this conference and then last year's is the determination to remake the conference culture and avoid people like that. Not that they haven't got something to say, but they have occupied the conference culture for so long and really in a certain sense have so stifled any real discussion of major issues that this was a unique event for that,
right.
for that
it's,
one aspect.
Their venues have turned into entertainment.
Yes,
and they're
exactly.
blocking real change. They're blocking
right,
real
exactly.
maps, real change, real
right.
real scholarship. Okay, so let's move on to Olaf Phillips because we haven't even gone through all the presentations.
Sunday, yeah,
Olaf
he was
next.
On Sunday.
Yeah.
He did, again, this was another one of those presentations that, for my part, I loved. And, in fact, it's difficult for me to pick a favorite presentation, you know, out of all the speakers
yeah.
there. But this one would be right at the top of my list of, you know, final contenders.
Right.
Because Olaf spoke about the old British mockumentary called Alternative 3. And you and I and some of your listeners have discussed this before. This was a mockumentary that appeared on ITV in Great Britain in the late 1970s, early 1980s, somewhere in there. And it was ostensibly a documentary that, you know, it was an April Fool joke was what it was. But it touched on things that were so weird and so deep that the producers began to be, you know, they had their phones tapped, they began to be followed, and it was all a huge April Fool's joke. But right. the basic premise was that there is a secret space program, okay, and it secretly landed on Mars in the early 1960s. It was a joint American-Russian mission. And as a component to this secret space program, the elites of the world were going around kidnapping some people and then talking other people, scientists, artists, managers, and so on and so forth, into entering this secret program and going to Mars to help build the human colony because the environment on Earth was falling apart, the planet was going to die, and, you know, they needed a Noah's Ark, essentially. That's what it was. And the interesting thing about Olaf's presentation is he went through that documentary, and it's about a 45-minute long, you know, it's not a long watch, but he went through point by point the alternative three mockumentary and pointed out factual parallels with each of the major premises in that documentary. And by the end of it, you know, I was just, I literally, Catherine, was just kind of sitting in the back of the hall there listening to him, and my mouth was wide open. it was wide open. I was sitting next to Jay Widener, and he turned to me, and he just laughed. He says, "You better shut your mouth, Joe, or, you know, you're flies going in and out of there." It was really, you know, again, yeah. That's one of those presentations that took you by surprise. And, you know, my hat's off to Olaf on that one. That was a
He's really integrated good a phenomenal amount of what's going on.
He really did.
Yeah, he really has. Did. Yeah. Yeah, and so next up was Linda Moulton Howe.
Yes. Well, Linda's been around, you know, for a very long time in the alternative research community. She's an investigative reporter. And again, you know, that's a different research method, but it's certainly a valid one. She, most people know her as having been involved with the earliest investigations of cattle mutilations.
Right.
She did some Emmy Award-winning work on cattle mutilations. She's also investigated crop circles, written an excellent book about those. But the interesting thing that she did is a presentation on a very, very strange, and I remember this story when it appeared years ago, and she broke it, on some very strange debris, if you want to call it that, that's clearly of a technological origin with very, very strange symbols on it, and talked to the individual that kind of clued her in about this. And basically what it is, it's self-actuating or self-activating software. And again, you stop and think about what this means, the implications of this, particularly in the context of secret space program, breakaway civilization. Well, we're talking artificial intelligence. We're talking biometrically activated software in a certain sense. So again, you just say those words and you think of the huge, huge implications that all [S2]
Right. [S1]
Of this has. And if indeed these things, this stuff is genuine and real, and I think I'm one of those that tends to think that where there's enough smoke, there's some fire.
Right.
You look at some of these things that she's uncovered, and then you stop and think, well, this has been going on for decades.
Yep.
What, you know, what do they really have?
Yep.
By way of internet, by way of networking, by way of data processing, and so on and so forth. It's huge.
Right. Okay, so I was next up, so I'll get you to explain what I said.
No, you're not going to. No.
Okay, so I tried to bring it way back to ground. So what I wanted to talk about was, okay, well, where's the money? And, you know, what is the implication of this to our economy? And I went through a couple of points. One was, you know, if you look at cash flows, 90% of the economic action in terms of what impacts you and me is in the low Earth orbit, because it's the satellites. You know, I tried to explain that the satellites are now part of the sea lanes of the 21st century. And Earth is basically being increasingly controlled, managed, manipulated, you know, trade process through the satellites. And so a lot of the PR and the movies is all about Mars and the moon You know, they're not saying, hey, you know, we're building a control mechanism to control and entrain you from the lower Earth orbit. So I wanted to get everybody focused on that and also what it meant in terms of the equity markets. You know, because if you look at the discussion of things transferring out of the black budget into private corporations, and then you look at the equity markets, that's exactly what you see happening. Those are the stocks. You know, if that's true, then those are the stocks that are doing well and sometimes often inexplicably well. And we talked a little bit about that. And then I brought up two points, which I think, you know, you and I always hammer. One is to talk about the economy and the financial system on planet Earth without integrating this aspect is really a material omission because it's become so huge. So it's, you know, I showed once again my balance sheet with a big question mark and saying, you know, we have to include that question mark in our map when we talk about the financial system and the economy. And then finally, I address the fact that if you look at, you know, the financial system, understanding the most important question we need to ask and answer is it an open or closed system? And we have an entire global system talking about it as if it's closed.
Yes.
But in fact, we have no... I couldn't prove to you in court that it's closed. In fact, if you look at the evidence, it looks much more to me like it's probably open.
Yep.
And so, you know, I asked the question, who owns the debt? I can't figure it out. I've tried. You know, where's the gold? How much is there? I can't figure that out. You know, so it gets back to, is this an open or closed system? Are we already trading multi-planet? And
well,
I think that question has to be put on the table.
Well, I definitely agree. And, you know, since we're on the subject of open and closed systems, and again, your presentation is one of those things that, well, when I was out talking, quite frankly, everybody was kind of talking about all these presentations, and particularly that one. When somebody asked me the question, I forget who it was, did I think that what you were talking about with low Earth orbit space and then, you know, deep space probes being the financial distinction, did I think the low Earth orbit things could possibly be part of a trading system for off-world
absolutely.
Financial trends? That was my answer. I said absolutely. You know, they're putting such huge amounts of investment in this, and that's going to require, in its own turn, a huge investment to protect it.
Right.
That this suggests to me that there's some aspect of this that is indeed meant for off-world trade. And, you know, we don't have to go to E.T. We can turn the clock back a couple of years and go online and find all those stories about, you know, setting up for internet broadcast on the moon, you know, and so on and so forth. So they're getting
ready. Well, I think, one of the questions, you know, we did this special on the legal issues, and we're going to do a series on the legal issues. And one of the questions we raised in the first one, you know, is the low Earth orbit the new offshore havens?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And then we had, you closed, you opened, but you also closed. So then just give us a minute or two on your final presentation.
Well, that was one of those serendipitous moments because, you know, you produced your pie chart with the question marks, you know, that there's a huge amount of money that we can't account for. And I kind of played off that. I didn't realize you were going to be talking about that. But in my last presentation, Cosmic Versailles, Cosmic War, one of the things that I pointed out in the first talk was there's six discrete definite areas where you can trace parallels between the provisions of the Treaty of Versailles and certain things that you notice in ancient lore and texts. But obviously one of the things that everybody talks about with Versailles is the idea of reparations or of a tribute or of a tithe. And I, you know, you have mentioned this many, many times in talks about space and finance, this idea that could some of this money simply be going off-world in the form of a tribute or a tithe. And when you look at the record, I think very clearly you have indications within ancient writings, within ancient lore, that there clearly is this idea of a tribute or a tithe or a reparation going off-world somehow to, you know, pay off whoever it was that beat us in the last round of the Cosmic War. So, yeah, you know, it was a serendipitous right. moment. You know, Olaf Phillips with Alternative 3 and the batch consignments. You know, again, I didn't anticipate, you know, that he was going to be talking about all that, but I talked about that in that final presentation as well, the idea that somebody could be kidnapping a lot of people around the world and simply sending them off world for slave labor, effectively.
Right. So then we get to my favorite presentation of all.
The round table.
The round table on Sunday night, which turned out to be, you know, I forgot we were doing a panel. You know, we were just figuring things out. You know, it was pretty amazing. Anyway, so give us your recap of the panel, and then I got a lot of questions about it.
Well, the round table was fun because the first one on Saturday night, Jay Widener, because Daniel List was still on his way to the conference, Jay Widener hosted, so he threw it open to questions, and he hadn't been to San Mateo last year where, you know, we all decided no more questions from the floor.
Right.
But even then, we had good questions this year. We didn't have so many people getting up to tell their story. But the Sunday night panel was really interesting because Daniel List did show up.
You know? He finally
made
it.
One of the things that was really odd was we started talking about the Phoenix Lights. And, you know, to me, that was kind of another bit of serendipity because, of course, Linda Moulton Howe was on the panel. And she was the one that kind of broke, you know, on Art Bell and all that. She was the one that was really there and covering the Phoenix Lights more or less as they happened. So, you know, we talked about that. There was some discussion of education. I remember somehow Common Core came up into all of this, and I went on my usual anti-education, American education rant, I'm afraid. We had questions about, you know, this was the panel discussion where people were asking, you know, why don't you invite the whistleblowers and the storytellers? And but it was a good discussion. It went on for 2 hours. You know, it was just kind of a freewheeling thing. I thought
right,
it was
and a lot of I would say there was a lot of integration and learning going on.
Yes,
on the people doing the talking. I wanted to bring up several points that came up mostly on the panel. One is there has been a lot more stuff going on over the last 2 years. Increasingly about the possibility of World War III. And one of the things that happened that I thought was very useful in Texas is we talked about whether or not the Cold War was really not a war between the Americans and the Russians. It was really a cover story for something related to humans versus someone else.
Yes.
And I think it was you who told the story of Gorbachev and Reagan offering to just, well, let's decommission all the nuclear weapons.
Yep. Yeah. Well,
and some of the anomalies. Maybe if you could describe that theory of, you know, the Cold War as a cover story for something else.
Well, that theory actually, that hypothesis was actually put out by Lieutenant Colonel Philip Corso in his book, The Day After Roswell. That book is an interesting book because it's a book that was initially, when it came out, greeted with almost a firestorm of enthusiasm and discussion. And then it began to be attacked by certain people within the ufology community and, for that matter, in the mainstream community that just shredded its premises. And I've never taken the view that the Colonel came out with this book to be entirely straightforward, but by the same token, I don't take the view that he was engaged in a deliberate campaign to deceive and lie. I think he had to be extraordinarily careful in that book.
Right.
So I think you have to be extraordinarily careful when you read it. But one of the things that he does in the book is that he states just toward the end of the book, and it's almost like at the very end of the book and leaving you right off the cliff. And he says that by the late 1980s, under Reagan's Star Wars program, we had managed to stalemate the extraterrestrials. And, you know, my comment was at the roundtable discussion, oh, we were at war. <You know>? There was something going on up there, and we weren't told, you know, but oh, here's an Army colonel saying, yeah, we were at war, and we managed to stalemate the situation. And then, in this context, he says something else very interesting, that the whole purpose of SDI was, of course, as we were told, to replace the mutually assured destruction doctrine. You know, if the Russians launch their missiles to annihilate us, well then, by golly, you know, in the moral muddle that doctrine introduces, we're going to launch our missiles and turn Russia into a glowing cinder as well. But what Corso maintains is, and you have to really just kind of look at this one with objective eyes, what Corso maintained was that the United States and the Soviet Union both built these massive thermonuclear stockpiles precisely as a defense against alien invasion. Now, I know that sounds nutty, but his reasoning is...
It doesn't sound nutty, because if you look at what a stockpile we created between the United States and Soviet, it never made any sense. We're creating far more than we need to kill each other.
Yeah.
You know, we could have killed each other many, many times. It didn't make any sense.
It was literally the solution to simply overwhelm them by sheer numbers. That you can't possibly shoot down 20,000 missiles all heading, you know, for the other continent in midair.
Right.
And this was the reasoning, according to Corso, that if they land in the United States, well, the Soviet Union would have enough missiles to defend itself, defend the planet, wipe out the aliens. If it landed in the Soviet Union, we'd have enough missiles to do the same. So in other words, his take is that mutually assured destruction, you know, the doctrine of the Cold War, was in fact a doctrine not so much being employed between the United States and the Soviet Union, but rather between planet Earth and somebody else. And that's very interesting because, you know, he said this, and I suggested this in last year's Secret Space Program conference as well, that the powers that be, the national security establishment, are going to play a careful game of space gunboat diplomacy. And the view that they're going to take is precisely to prevent any direct alien or extraterrestrial interference in human affairs. And that's exactly what Corso says happened. So, you know, the discussion was very, very interesting.
Well, and it may not be alien. It could be a breakaway civilization.
Exactly. It could be something human. You know, and people have to understand, when I say alien or extraterrestrial, you know, I'm not talking grays or lizards or, you know, fishmen or anything, because the preponderance, in my opinion, the preponderance of ancient evidence is that these extraterrestrials look like us, walk like us, talk like us.
Right.
They're our genetic cousins, more than anything else. All the rest of it, I think, is kind of, you know, operatic stage props.
Well, here's the problem. You know, one of the reasons I always avoided this topic is the disinformation is so, you know, it's like looking for truffles in a pile of, you know what. No, it's hard. And that's why I so appreciate these conferences, because you're talking, you know, you've got a whole lot of people who have enough integrity to say what they know, say what they believe, but not try and concoct it into something it's not.
Right.
You know, it's interesting when I look, you know, and I've been talking to you for years about the fact that I think Putin is getting help from the West, and there's a lot more coordination behind the scenes than they make it out to be. You know, and the more time goes on, the more it looks like, particularly in Syria, to me, it looks like they're playing a ping pong game. But, you know, I can't figure out what's up, but I was watching about 3 weeks ago the videos of the explosions in Syria. And you're talking about these deep bombs, you know, that they explode and then that opens up so the bomb can drop underground and go off again. And they, if you look at all these videos just from what's available on YouTube, you're talking about massive attacks on underground facilities. And I'm thinking, the underground facilities in Syria have to be unbelievable.
Yeah.
And then you think, what's going on?
Yeah. Yeah, there clearly is something going on. I've seen those videos. There's clearly something going on because they're using, I'll be blunt, they're using either tactical nukes, which I doubt, mm-hmm. or they're using thermobaric bombs, which could be, or they're using some new type of weapon. And the reason I hesitate to say one or the other is because you're looking at these things and some of the signatures are signatures of nuclear weapons or appear to be.
Right.
And then some of the signatures are signatures of thermobaric weapons or appear to be. So they're using something there. And what really gets me, just like you said, is the underground infrastructure in Syria that extensive?
Yeah, because if you just if you look at the bombs, what it's implying is a fantastic underground infrastructure.
Yeah, yeah. And if so, how did ISIS get a hold of it so quickly?
Well, if you look at the timing, there's no way ISIS built it that quickly. So who built it and what is it and what's really going on?
That's precisely what I'm saying is you know,
right.
They're bombing all of this underground stuff. And the story, cover story is ISIS is, you know, what Russia's going after. Well, then how did they get a hold of it so quickly? So something else is going on here. And I'm with you. There's more going on to this war on terror than meets the eye. Let's just put it that way.
Well, I've always believed the surveillance and all of this stuff was, you know, they're really trying to figure out who's who in the population.
I do, too. And we talked about that. I talked about that in my last presentation. We talked about that during the roundtable discussion. I think they're trying to find who these, if, you know, granted for the sake of argument, they're here and walk among us, you know, that sort of proposition. I think they're trying to find out who they are.
Right.
And that raises the question of why, because that implies that something has gone wrong, that whatever arrangements may have been in place are terminated, that there's been some sort of breach of trust, and now they want to find out, you know, who's here and where are they?
One of the things I brought up, because I think it's such an important point, we talked about it when we talked about the wrap-up, is that we have watched in the last 20 to 30 years the Peace of Westphalia torn up.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And,
yeah.
We're now operating in a world where within any given jurisdiction, the sovereign government doesn't have a monopoly on force. We have a whole variety of players, some of whom are invisible, who are above the law and bring force to bear. And it's very confusing for anybody trying to operate within it.
Right.
It's very medieval.
It's very medieval because you have essentially three types of things going on. You have secret organizational players with international connections and finance and so on, you know, like the Templars. Well, you know, this is what we're looking at with the terrorist networks. And I'm still adamant and insistent that we cannot ignore this post-war Nazi fascist international and all
deep
ties to radical Islam. Then you've got corporate players, you know, particularly in the United States, you have corporations that are now fielding mercenary armies. And you raised the point in your discussion at a presentation at the Secret Space Program conference, you know, who owns the data? You've got the defense corporations in this country, which are really the sovereign entities that own the technology, that own the data.
Right.
And therefore are capable of fielding, if they should choose to do so, and some have, capable of fielding mercenary military force. And then
it's
finally, you've got sovereign governments.
Right. When was it? It was before 2001. There's a group who was trying to get me to run for president in New Hampshire to bring transparency to a lot of the issues that you and I talk about.
Uh-huh.
And I wrote an article called Why I Declined to Run for President of the United States, explaining that it would be absolutely pointless. You know, in other words, the only thing it could do is bring transparency to some issues, but it wouldn't change anything because that's not the way you go about getting something changed.
Right.
Anyway, so my sister called me up and said, well, what would it take? What would it take for you to run for president, to serve as president? What would it take? And I said, okay, well, I'll give you the list. The first thing is I would need 250 licenses to kill. No questions asked. And she went ballistic. She said, that is the most amoral, unethical, you know, thing I've ever heard. I said, look, you can't do a job unless you have the power and authority to do it.
That's right.
And you're talking about running a criminal enterprise. In fact, 250. I mean, now I think I was being way too, you know, I would need thousands. So I just said, you can't. You're in an environment where everybody, you know, has their own hit team and is running around killing. And if you can't, then you're dead in the water.
That's right.
And, you know, that I keep thinking of The Godfather. This is the life we've chosen.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I do think that there's an element, you know, we're looking at, I think, Catherine, and I think especially with this secret space program, breakaway civilization idea, we're looking at, with that idea, one aspect of a mafia. And, you know, to me, this is the other big model I hope people really latch on to, because the mafia can, you know, the different families, the different bosses can all cooperate and coordinate
right.
at a very high level, even internationally, right. while at the same time they're shooting at each other.
Right.
And I think this is what we have going on in the world.
Yes.
There's an element
yes.
of cooperation at a very high level. But there's also, I think, we're beginning to see signs now that they're starting to shoot at each other.
Yes. The Midianite thing is upon us.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are looking at the beginning yeah. of, you know, I think we're in World War III. World War III is being fought covertly. And we're now
right.
in the stage where the factions have started to shoot at each other. You know, Putin started this with getting rid, literally, of some of the Rothschild interests in his country. And now, you know, with the death of this guy that founded RT, I'm suspecting we're looking at the beginning of precisely this, a mafia shooting war. And nobody,
right.
you know, if Mr. Rockefeller or Queen Elizabeth II think they're immune from this, you know, they've got another thing coming. I think everybody.
My fear is they can always settle their wars by agreeing to steal from the rest of us.
Yeah, yeah, that's
yeah,
true too.
So. Okay, one of the things that came up that is something I've explored on your encouragement, and you know, I just feel like I have 90% to go. One of the things that came up is the Hadron Collider. And I put
yeah.
up on our website the quote from you about the Hadron Collider. Describe just very briefly what the collider is and why, what the official story is, and then why we think there may be a deeper story.
Well, the collider, the Large Hadron Collider, hadrons are basically the heavy particles like protons, neutrons, and that, so on. So that's really all hadron means. So a hadron collider is designed to whirl and smash protons, neutrons, and heavy lead ions, things of this sort together. The collider is actually itself the last of five interlinked colliders. There's a linear accelerator that gets the proton stream going, that gets it injected, and then there's three other colliders between the linear accelerator and the Large Hadron Collider that bring the proton stream up to speed. Okay, so in other words, the story is that they need bigger and bigger colliders at working at ever more powerful energies of collisions. You know, we're now in the tera electron volts of collisions. In order to tweak out and make fine adjustments to the standard model of particle physics and what went on right after the Big Bang. Now, to me, Catherine, the whole story, and I tried to point this out very briefly at the conference because somebody asked me about this. To me, the whole story is dubious in the extreme for two and actually three very good reasons. The first reason is financial. CERN, effectively, is kind of a sovereign financial entity. It is a sovereign entity, much like the Bank of
Right.
International Settlements. So in other words, we have a cosmology cartel in Geneva, and with a budget to build the thing of $6 billion plus. Now, folks, $6 billion plus, that's 3 B-2 stealth bombers.
Right.
This is, you know, this is an expenditure that, in its sheer scale, suggests to me a military purpose.
Right, and one of the things we know about the Swiss is they don't waste money.
They don't waste money, no.
They don't waste money. This is not France. This is what's...
This is not France. You know, all the major members of CERN, the biggest contributor to CERN, of course, is Germany.
Right.
You know, and again, the Germans don't waste
money. And they don't waste money either.
They don't waste their money either, no. So, you know, this is a huge international project. The second thing that is extremely suspicious about CERN is that CERN... Most people don't realize that the internet itself was in part made public because of the plans to build this collider. Most people are totally unaware of this. But the fact is that CERN is the internet's largest user. And the reason why is you have hundreds of scientists all over the world that are part of the particle physics team at CERN that are sent different results via the internet. It's also, believe it or not, the world's largest data producer, because the particle collisions are generating billions of pieces of data every second.
Wow.
So it's also, yeah, every second. So it's also one of the world's hugest experiments in data management. How do you manage billions of parts of data and get the, you know, filter out what you want to look at and get it sent to the scientific team investigating it? So all of the, just on these management principles alone, I think it's very clear you're looking at a military structure.
Right.
Now, the final thing here, though, is the machine itself, because as I pointed out during the panel discussion, you have the collider itself, and then above it you have another circular collider called the proton synchrotron. It's much smaller, but if you look at how it sits vis-a-vis the Large Hadron Collider, it sits canted off the axis of rotation of the Large Hadron Collider, such that if you were to put them both on the same plane, the proton synchrotron would actually cross the rim of the Large Hadron Collider. So in other words, if you look at this machine and dispense the idea that it has anything to do with particle physics, the huge magnetic fields alone, the fact that you're rotating a proton stream in opposite directions in the LHC, suggests to me that you have a huge magnetic torsion machine. And the field strength of some of the detectors inside the collider, I think the Atlas detector is somewhere around 8 teslas. That's about 15,000 times stronger than the local magnetic field of the Earth. And when you're talking about such strength, Catherine, I defy anybody to tell me that this machine is a closed system machine.
Right.
Because
so what is it doing to the electromagnetic field of the Earth?
Well, that's exactly where I was going, because there are now people tracking every time that thing is turned on and, you know, juiced up, the magnetic field in the northern hemisphere of the Earth dips. So in other words, it's playing with the magnetosphere of the entire planet. And
right.
Additionally, that suggests to me that, you know, the standard theory is that the Earth's core is a liquid core of superheated iron and nickel spinning with the axis of rotation of the Earth, creating an electrical current which produces the magnetic field of the planet. So in other words, this machine could be affecting planetary physics, not simply in the magnetosphere, but possibly even in the planetary core.
Right.
So this is a planetary-sized machine. And the final pièce de résistance here is that, you know, I'm a big fan of the Hungarian electrical engineer, genius man, by the name of Gabriel Krohn. And Crone devised a system of examining and dealing with electrical machines mathematically that required the use of higher dimensional topologies in order to deal with the simplest electrical machines. So what I've just said is that the Large Hadron Collider is a hyperdimensional machine, because if you were to describe it in its entirety in mathematics, you would have to use higher dimensional languages to do it. So in other words, it's a hyperdimensional machine just by its mere existence. Now they finally come out and admitted that, oh yeah, we might be looking for parallel dimensions, parallel universes, higher dimensions, and so on and so forth. So in other words, it's not simply, even by their own admission, it is not simply about particle physics. It's about something else.
One of the most important points I thought you made at the whole conference is when you said there is a discipline of science between biology and physics.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's always disturbed me, that blank. You know, it's almost like it's that whole area has been vaccinated by the official reality.
Yes, and I'll tell you, this is precisely what Dr. LaViolette's research is about, because if there is a deep, formally explicit relationship between biology and physics, it has to be in systems theory.
Right.
And again, you know, he stressed the idea of analogical thinking in his talk. And, you know, anybody that's a member of my website and has listened to the vid chats and so on the website will tell you that this is the essence of this topological metaphor I've been talking about in so many of my books.
Right.
It's analogical, it's systems thinking. And this, again, you know, is such a deep part of reality, this idea that an analogy itself is so much a part of consciousness, and consciousness in turn is what I think unites the physical world and the spiritual world, is this ability to think analogically.
Right.
We're on the cusp of new things, and in this respect I think the Hadron Collider is really a deep black project about these things. The particle physics is the cover story. There's much more going on. You know,
yeah.
In the last book, The Third Way, I pointed out that yet another experiment that they might be doing, since they have such massive computer power at their disposal, is that they themselves might be running correlation experiments. And by that, I mean, what happens if we turn on our collider on such and such a day, when the planetary positions in the solar system are in XYZ position? And what is there going to be any noticeable effect on the human population? In other words, I think part of the secret project could actually be a kind of physico-social engineering experiment as well, because they've got the computing power to do all of that.
Right.
It's a huge possibilities.
The next thing I want to bring up is there was an interesting article that Ambrose Pritchard Evans had several weeks ago, talking about how after the Paris climate change meeting, we're going to see an explosion of new energy technology coming from renewables, and it's going to radically change everything, and you're going to have an enormous blossoming of wealth. And I mm-hmm. thought, I wonder if they're going to use climate change as air cover for bringing, you know, energy technology out of the black budget. You know, I try to keep an eye on that line.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is, if you look at the technology that we believe exists in this universe and is being operated by humans, whoever they are, it's fair to say that if they really do re-engineer that out, as Corso described, through the corporations, we're talking about a very different world and economy than what we have now.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I think there's a possibility, and you and I have discussed this too, that in a certain sense, Catherine, I think that they're at a crucial juncture in so many ways. There's clearly something that they're in a hurry about.
Mm-hmm.
They are clearly in a hurry to, you know, get this whole Islamic thing battened down and buttoned down. And I think they've kind of come to the conclusion that this might last the next century. But they're clearly in a hurry about something. And we've seen, you've tracked it, I've tracked it, other people in this community have tracked it, all the stories that seem to be just coming now at a slow drip, slow, steady drip of this energy technology, that energy technology, you know, this car running on water, that car running on water, you know, on and on this goes, and it's getting closer and closer to the mainstream. So I think Pritchard is right. I think something could come out of this climate change conference, because you cannot, and this is part of the model that always disturbed me, you cannot assume that these people are going to tax the carbon footprint without having some alternative to put in its place.
Right.
Because if you tax the carbon footprint without that alternative, you're taxing your own productivity, and eventually these people lose their power and wealth. Because
right.
They are parasites. It is a parasitic system, and, you know, they are dependent on, you know, the average Joe. So you cannot do this unless you are prepared to bring out a technology, and you're going to force people into its adaptation by taxing those who stay on the old technology for too long.
Right. Right. It's also going to make it much easier to control them, because the big problem, if you radically reduce the energy cost, how are you going to control the population? How are you going to control?
Right.
You know, this has been your control model. If you give up your control model, you need a new control model.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
And I think, we've discussed this many times. The real problem, George Ann Hughes, you know, and I discussed
right.
this many times.
God
the real
her.
Problem, yeah, God bless her. The real problem the elite has had with these alternative energy technologies has been its potential for weaponization and proliferation. So had they let this out a century ago, the mechanism for surveillance simply wasn't in play. It wasn't in place to be able to track any dangerous use of this. Now they've got that system in place.
Right.
And I think you're seeing it for precisely this reason. You're seeing more and more of this stuff leaking out and getting closer and closer to the mainstream. They're going to do something, Catherine. I just feel it in my bones. In the next 10 to 20 years, and it may be even be tomorrow. You know, who knows?
I can't tell whether it's going to be little incrementals or a big leap. I just keep an eye on it and watch it.
Yeah, I do too. But I'll tell you, my thinking is that if it's a big leap, then there's some external pressure on them that they've got to do it quickly.
Right.
I think
part of it is they want to break through. You know, they want gigantic breakthrough productivity so that they can do the engineering they need to build the base that takes them into space in a big way.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
So, you know, if they're getting external pressure to do this in a hurry, then they're going to make their big leap in a hurry and, you know, damn the consequences. But
right.
I suspect that if, you know, putting myself into their shoes, I would prefer to do it in a slow, controlled, you know, using your slow burn model, controlled,
right.
managed way.
Right.
So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. You know, if they do this quickly, then they're under some sort of pressure, and then we have to look and figure out, well, what's the pressure that they're under?
Well, you know, the beauty of calling it solar power plants in space is nobody can check to see if it's really solar.
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
Hence all the smart meters that can work off of satellites with the cell towers. Okay, which brings me to my favorite topic, as you know, the drum I beat, is our movie this week is The Kingsman, which is an absolutely dreadful movie.
I haven't seen it, to be honest with you.
Oh, it's just dreadful. But it's basically a Silicon Valley kind of billionaire decides he's going to depopulate the planet by building through the satellites and entrainment infrastructure, and gets everybody, you know, he creates the technology so when sufficiently trained they'll all jump up and kill each other. And one of the prototypes is a church, a Pentecostal church in the southern USA where 200 people in the congregation get up and kill each other is a particularly gruesome scene. I don't recommend it. Well, but it shows the power of the technology. And, you know, I don't think they've got that. They've got it to that level, you know, sort of World War. What was the zombie movie with Brad Pitt? World War Z. Anyway, but it's sort of the World War Z using entrainment technology. And I think one of the things that can really make you feel very Orwellian is walking around the world not understanding that this technology exists and we're all subject to it. Right. And so, hence, I bang the drums and kind of try and get people to watch all the movies that have it. But I do think it's one of the reasons that the satellite infrastructure is becoming increasingly important. This is not just media and communications and sort of brainwashing. I mean, it's really brainwashing. Yeah. And anyway, so I just wanted to bring that up. I didn't know if you had any comments.
No, I agree. In fact, if you know, it doesn't take much research if you go online and search for mind control technologies, mind manipulation techniques. You know, there's a hard and soft form of all this. But yes, there's no doubt in my mind that space-based systems would be absolutely vital for this. Now, the real question again is: the ultimate target simply us?
Right.
you know, that raises the nasty question of all those ET bodies that we hear ufology maintaining that they found and autopsied and so on. You know, I've never really bought into many of those stories, but assuming for the sake of argument, you know, that would give you valuable information on the sort of entrainment technology that you would need to deal with something like that. So, yeah, anything like that I think is fair game, you know, is an open
right.
possible scenario.
What is that little machine the X-Men use to blank your mind out? It ends in Izer, I forget what it is, but things are starting to look a lot more like Men in Black.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they are. They are.
I know.
Go ahead.
No, you go.
Well, these technologies, this idea of memory wipes, we don't need to look very far to see that this is definitely a possibility. I mean, look at Sirhan Sirhan, for crying out loud.
Right.
The Robert Kennedy assassination. I don't think that there's a person that's ever really looked into that and examined this that has seen and heard the tapes of the psychiatrist hypnotizing him that can come to any other conclusion that this man has some sort of pre-hypnotic suggestion, a block in his memory that has never been penetrated.
Right.
So, yeah. They
well,
played,
it's
you know,
interesting
they
when
memory.
The Amish, remember the school shooting when all the Amish kids were killed, Amish kids were killed, and the Amish went over to the wife of the assassin and, you know, reached out and spoke of her as, you know, and him as a victim as well.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably because they knew,
yep.
you know, that this is not the person doing it. This is there's a deeper story.
There's a deeper
well,
story.
Well, I will tell you, yeah. Just the last thing I wanted to dive into. Well, before I go into my last thing, was there anything else you wanted to bring out? There was so much that came up. It was such a rich discussion. But was there any other?
Yeah, I'm a blur about it. I really am. Seriously, I came home exhausted.
Uh-huh.
I came home from that conference exhausted in a good way.
Yeah.
Because there was so many ideas percolating, not just, you know, in the presentations, but when you get out and start talking with people, you know, in the little informal conversations that inevitably go on, and for me are always the funnest part of these types
yeah.
of conferences. There were so many ideas. I just, it's all a blur to me. You know,
it was amazing.
To write
I had
some
one,
of it down.
One of our smartest subscribers come up and said, did you notice all the weather warfare patterns that were happening with all the signers to the TPP as
yep.
they came in? And he sent me all the links and he said, you know, I think the reason all these guys went along is they didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
Now, I haven't looked at it yet, but, you know, it was there was one of those every hour.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
It doesn't surprise me.
Well, the last thing I wanted to talk about was, you know, I came home, I wasn't quite as tired, but I felt such a deep satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
It was so marvelous to be among, you know, 300 responsible adults and more coming in on stream.
Yep.
Who were just interested in figuring out the truth and not, you know, there was no one there who was pushing an agenda.
Yes,
they're all just trying to find the truth. And some are scientists, some are scholars, some are, I'm just a deal doer, you know, some are investigative reporters. Everybody's got a different story. They're just trying to figure out the truth. My favorite moment was, and I can't stop laughing about it, and you kind of had to be there, was after the panel, a couple came up. They're very attractive, sort of responsible. You could see, you know, these are hardworking, disciplined people. And they came up and they were really kind of floating on air. And the guy said, you know, I just want to thank you. I watched all the presentations online from last year. And when I found out this was going to be in our area, I had to come and I've enjoyed this tremendously. And his wife, who was clearly a very good sport, was, you know, she was kind of like, her face was a combination of amusement and kind of shock. And she said, well, I didn't watch any of the presentations from last year. I had no idea any of this was going on. This is all completely new news to me. And frankly, I just got to go home and lie down. And I couldn't stop laughing. Her face was just, you know, it was priceless. Because you could tell, you know, it was so much new information that was so paradigm shifting that normally she would have said, oh, well, you know, I don't buy this. But except all of the presentations, the people were so credible. You know, it was just credible.
Well, the credibility comes from the fact that every single presentation, there was something by way of documentation.
Right.
You know, and I made a joke about this during one of the roundtable discussions. I forget which one it was, but you know, it's my old tired, worn out soapbox song reference footnote. You know,
right.
I make the joke that my epitaph is going to read, "He gave his life for footnotes," because so much in this alternative research community is storytelling that when you get around to even some of the researchers, they don't footnote that, and if they try, they don't know how.
I don't know if you've ever looked at the complete footnotes on the Dylan Reed story, but they're mind-boggling. There are hundreds of thousands of pages of SEC documents that we scanned in and put.
Oh yeah, I did look at
it. It's all footnoted and cross, you know. The website is I would say it's 80% of the volume is footnotes.
It's footnotes, yes.
Right.
It's referencing. It's giving people the sources. And that, I think, more than anything else, is what people can see when they look at these presentations. Because I can't think of any of the presenters there that did not make a reference. Well, you can find this here or you can find it there. You know, this is what I think is really creating the credibility for these conferences, is that they're highlighting research. They're not highlighting whistleblowers. They're not highlighting, you know, anonymous storytellers or anonymous sources. This is just people coming to share what they've put together. And, you know, it looks to us this way, and we're tossing it out there, and it may look another way to somebody else. I think what's happening is that these conferences are generating a group of people and giving them the tools to go out and look at other things themselves.
Right.
So, in other words, it's not just a conference culture that is being created. It is a culture of inquiry.
And Olaf Phillips, I thought, did a great job of saying, you know, you're going to have to figure this out for yourselves.
Absolutely.
Everybody here is going to tell you the best that they've found, but you're going to have to figure this out yourself. There's no paint by numbers here, you know.
Yeah, there isn't.
The other thing I thought was very powerful this year was, you know, we came together last year. We connected a lot of dots. We had a year to chew it and the presentations online and back and forth. And now it's like we've gone to a whole new level. A couple people said to me, I was really afraid this was going to be a repeat of last year. There was no repeat. This is like a huge shift up.
Oh, yeah, it was. It was.
Yeah. So we figured out a lot over a year.
Well, it built on last year.
Yeah.
It did build on last year, but it wasn't a repeat of last year.
Right.
And this, again, I think is the other thing that distinguished this conference from the run-of-the-mill conference in the alternative community. Because you go to so many of those, and it's the same people telling the same stories over and over and over again.
Right.
You know, preaching the same memes and the same agendas and so on. It's the same thing over and over again. But this one wasn't. I made a deliberate point in my presentations to build off of what I said last year. And then you had people, you know, Walter built on things that he's done. You brought in new information from totally unexpected quarters. You know, this is what we need. And I think the conference organizers over there in the Netherlands know this and are clearly planning other events like this in different fields.
Well, they're planning on three the coming year. I put up the little video we did last year on the Global BEM team. It's up on the Solari.com.
Uh-huh.
And so you can kind of meet and see the organizers. And I was really lucky because I was in Amsterdam for 3 weeks in September and October, and I got a chance to really spend some more time with him. In fact, I dragged Jeroen to his first opera. And I just have to tell, I want everybody to hear this. After we came out of the opera, I said, okay, one of my fantasies is we find some serious money and commission Joseph to write an opera on the breakaway civilization.
Oh, no.
So that's what I want you to think about. How much money would it take to get you to write an opera on the breakaway civilization? Because I have to tell you, Joseph, I think it would be a huge hit.
I haven't composed in so long, and the trouble with composing is it takes so much time and concentration, and you literally have to put yourself in a. I don't know that I could do it. I probably couldn't do it.
Well, could produce it. We could hire composers. Do you know what I mean?
Me produce an opera? I wouldn't know where to start. You know, the closest.
I don't know. Think of the number that would get you to do it. That's what you have to. You have to look at it the other way around. How much would it cost for you to say, okay, you know, I'll sit down and figure out how to write an opera. I know you could do it if you wanted.
It has to be enough for me to buy a gimungously huge harpsichord, free and clear after taxes.
Anyway, I just have to tell you, I think it could revolutionize modern opera. I think it would be a huge hit. Let's face it, the Germans have not outdone the Italians on opera, but this could do it, you know.
Well, yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. Okay. Well, all I can tell you is it was a great event, and it was very for me. I come back and I'm having trouble getting back in official reality mode.
Yeah.
It's almost as though I've shifted permanently and I can't get back. Like, okay, I can't, you know, I don't have the energy for that anymore. It takes a huge amount of energy to pretend the official reality. And
yeah,
what I see in the world is the official reality is wearing thin more and more and more and more and more.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's really wearing thin. And so I don't know what's going to happen over the next year, but I think that erosion process is going to continue, particularly if the Midianite thing is happening, which I agree with you. It really is the gods are warring. So
yeah.
It's just going to keep wearing thin. So we're going to have a lot to talk about because heavens knows what's going to leak out, but you know it's going to be a lot. So
it's going to be an interesting I honestly think it's going to be an interesting few months just up to the new year.
Yeah.
I really do. I get the feeling that this is kind of the last gasp for the old line oligarchs. I really do. And the new bloods just aren't sophisticated enough. They just can't pull this off. They're bad actors. I mean, look at Jeb and Hillary.
Those guys are oldies. It's interesting. I saw a presentation by Rubio. You know, I don't pay much attention to the campaigns, but Rubio was explaining why you needed a young person, mm-hmm. and he was dead on right. It was compelling. I think Jeb and Hillary are just too old for the job right now because if you look at the physical energy it takes to deal with a multipolar world where the Treaty of Westphalia is torn up, you're talking about massive physical energy and enormous, you need very enormous positive can-do energy to do it. And they don't fit the profile of what's needed. You know, when the guys who backed Obama profiled him, you know, they had a lot. You know, they basically said you need a Ninja Turtle, not a Lone Ranger. So I don't know. But I will say this about the countdown to 2016. So I'm going to give this tidbit away. I've warned you about it. But tomorrow I am mailing to you your Christmas Advent calendar from Roslyn Chapel for the conspiracy scholar who has everything, the ultimate Advent calendar from Scotland.
Okay, I'll look
so you it. Can... You can count down the days with your Roslyn Chapel Advent calendar.
Okay, well, I'll look forward to that. I'll have to get out all my old Masonic costumery. No, that's a joke for the Masons. I did make that joke about my presentations. I did it kind of deliberately so that I could make the joke. I had 33 slides in each of my presentations. So, you know, the conspiracy theorists out there can have
a field day. Are you ready for this? You had 33 slides and you had two presentations. So now you've got 332, which is the skull and bones.
Skull and bones, that's right.
There you go.
Oh, that's good. Yep, that's good.
Okay, well, Joseph, you have a wonderful evening. Thank you so much for joining us on the Solaria Report.
Okay, you too, Catherine. Thanks for having me back.